This material expands the violence viability architecture, providing a dynamic systems framework that links ecological limits, institutional capacity, and cultural narratives to explain the stability or collapse of complex civilizations.
Yeah, and honestly, it is a highly sophisticated, incredibly rigorous white paper.
It really is. So we're going to dive straight into big picture feedback focused on completeness and focus, significance and relevance, and structure and flow, to help elevate this work even further.
Right, let's get into it.
Let's look closely at the section discussing the formalization of the viability function and the introduction of information systems.
The integration of the information and media layer feels somewhat isolated from the foundational mathematical model of the architecture.
Yeah, I noticed that exact gap as well.
I mean, the material makes such a strong case for the importance of the epistemic commons, right? Highlighting how fragmented realities and, you know, strategic disinformation campaigns really accelerate systemic fragility.
Absolutely. And Section 8 does an excellent job introducing modern information systems as this crucial transmission vector.
Mm-hmm.
The text articulates how the current attention economy and algorithmic polarization act as amplifiers for emotional contagion.
Right. It argues really convincingly that digital platforms basically hijack the cognitive perceptions of populations,
which fundamentally alters how societies interpret ecological or economic stress.
Exactly. But there is a notable weakness here when we move from that prose to the formal architecture.
Right.
When we look at the dynamic formula provided in Appendix A, specifically where viability over time is defined as a function of the core variables, it just doesn't explicitly encode this epistemic layer.
It doesn't. The math relies heavily on life ground integrity, institutional capacity, cultural orientation, power distribution, reserves, and delay.
Yeah.
But it leaves out the very information systems that the narrative just spent an entire section arguing are central to modern civilizational cognition.
Which raises a big question. Is there a risk that focusing solely on those physical and traditional institutional variables might, you know, overlook the primary engine of modern polarization?
I think so. The formula as it stands implies that information is merely a passive medium.
Right, rather than an active independent variable that can independently drive systemic collapse. The analytical rigor established in the prose simply isn't mirrored in that final structural formula.
Because the text paints this vivid picture of a distributed cognitive entrainment, right, where algorithms prioritize outrage.
Yes.
Which in turn chronologically activates biological threat responses across millions of people simultaneously.
It's a great concept.
But then when the reader arrives at the formal synthesis, that vital transmission vector just vanishes from the equation.
It's gone.
It feels like a missing bridge between the media ecology exploration and the mathematical architecture.
Which leads us to a clear suggestion. The authors should integrate the informational layer directly into the formal dynamic model.
Okay, how would they do that?
Well, they need to explicitly map it as a multiplier or maybe an independent variable within the existing cultural or institutional equations.
That makes sense.
Ensuring the formal model accurately reflects the complexity of the modern world where information systems are just as consequential as physical infrastructure that will tighten up the entire theoretical framework.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of modifying the core variables themselves?
What do you mean?
As a concrete example, they could add an E standing for the epistemic commons or the epistemic environment directly to the viability function.
Oh, I see.
This would formally recognize information systems as a standalone structural pillar alongside ecology, institutions, and culture.
That makes sense, but could the evidence also support a different conclusion? Like, maybe embedding it within an existing variable.
How so?
If they want to preserve the original triad of the architecture, they could explicitly define the cultural orientation variable, the C, as a mathematical function of information flow.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, in the appendix, they could write this as C as a function of I.
Right, demonstrating visually that a society's cultural narrative is not static.
Exactly. It's continuously mediated, modified, and sometimes entirely manufactured by its media ecosystem.
Mathematically operationalizing the concept that culture is continuously downstream of the information layer would be a highly effective approach.
It really would. It avoids adding unnecessary letters to the core triad while still acknowledging that culture in the 21st century cannot be calculated without factoring in algorithmic amplification.
Taking that a step further, we can apply this same integration to the visual diagrams.
Yeah, let's look at figure one.
The civilizational entrainment model. The diagram maps the flow from life conditions to physiological regulation and then directly to cognitive perception.
Mm-hmm.
A concrete way to implement our suggestion would be to add a distinct visual node for algorithmic amplification right between the cognitive perception phase and the narrative attractors phase.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is how figure one visualizes the biological and sociological feedback loops.
Yeah, it's super detailed.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this diagram. Inserting that specific node would ground the abstract concept of emotional contagion into a precise structural location.
Yes, it shows the reader exactly where digital media intervenes to artificially amplify threat detection before it solidifies into an adversarial cultural narrative.
It would clarify the mechanics of modern polarization instantly.
Exactly. Rather than just discussing the attention economy in the text, that single visual addition in Figure 1 makes it a structural component of the systemic failure pathway.
Absolutely. Now, moving from the mechanics of information to the dynamics of political economy, we run into a different kind of structural opportunity.
So, a key theme running through this material seems to be the idea that vested interests intentionally block adaptation, introducing the vested interest audit found in Appendix B.
The vested interest audit is a powerful diagnostic tool, but it currently lacks a strategic framework for overcoming the obstructions it successfully identifies.
Yeah, the weakness here is that the audit stops short of providing the prospective changemaker with a mechanism for action.
Right. Appendix B provides this really sharp analytical method for diagnosing regulatory capture and strategic obstruction.
It asks all the right questions.
It really does. Who benefits from the current arrangement? What is the narrative justification? Who are the institutional gatekeepers?
It allows a reader to distinguish between a genuine capacity failure, where a society simply lacks the resources to adapt, and manufactured scarcity, where powerful actors deliberately maintain bottlenecks.
But it leaves the reform coalitions mentioned earlier in Section 7 without a structural playbook for bypassing these specific blockades.
Yes. The audit maps how the system is captured, but offers no methodology for breaking that capture.
As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that systemic analysis must eventually serve human agency.
Exactly. Section 7 dedicates significant space to discussing how social movements, reform coalitions, and knowledge institutions are the actual drivers of historical transitions.
They're the agents mobilizing during crisis windows.
But equipping them with the vested interest audit in its current form is essentially handing them a thermometer when they need a prescription.
That is the exact friction point. The suggestion to resolve this is to expand the audit to include an actionable countermeasure phase.
I like that.
This expansion would directly link the diagnostic results produced by the audit to the political agency and coalition building strategies discussed earlier in the text.
By pairing the diagnosis of obstruction with a corresponding strategy for circumvention, the tool evolves from a purely academic framework into an applied instrument for systemic change.
That's fascinating. What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to that idea?
Well, a strict diagnostician might argue that an audit's sole job is to assess, not to prescribe.
Sure.
They might say that mapping out specific political interventions pushes the white paper too far into the realm of activism rather than objective systems analysis.
That's a valid concern if the texts were purely descriptive. But given the high stakes of civilizational viability outlined in the earlier chapters, leaving the intervention ambiguous actually undermines the material's practical utility.
That's true. The authors have already introduced these reform coalitions as necessary variables for systemic survival.
Right. So providing them with a strategic countermeasure column isn't activism. It's just completing the operational framework.
Let's discuss concrete examples of how to build out this countermeasure phase.
Okay.
The authors could add a sixth diagnostic category to the Appendix B audit titled Leverage Points for Reform.
Oh, that's clean.
This would transition the audit from a document of observation to a document of intervention.
Those leverage points would need to map directly onto the specific obstruction mechanisms identified in the previous columns.
Definitely.
For instance, if the audit identifies narrative justification as the primary obstruction mechanism, say, A vested interest is aggressively framing environmental deregulation as a necessity for economic survival. The corresponding leverage point might outline how to strategically mobilize knowledge institutions.
Right. It would give specific parameters on how independent media and academic bodies can disrupt that specific narrative with empirical data and counterframing.
The intervention becomes tailor-made to the pathology.
It tells the reform coalition exactly which lever to pull based on the type of blockage they're facing.
Exactly. Or, to give another concrete example, let's say the audit reveals that the primary blockade is institutional gatekeepers exercising regulatory capture over a specific public utility.
Okay.
The countermeasure column wouldn't just say, stop the gatekeepers.
No, that's too vague.
It would outline structural strategies for utilizing decentralized legal challenges, or detail how to mobilize social movements to apply sustained external pressure during a specific window of systemic vulnerability.
It provides a strategic playbook that corresponds precisely to the type of systemic sabotage at play.
Empowering the reader with that actionable playbook actually brings us perfectly to how the author handles historical examples.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is the theoretical actors introduced in Section 7, the civic organizations and researchers. They need to see how these interventions have played out in reality.
Yes, but the historical case studies of transformative repair remain largely narrative and are not yet fully integrated into the rigorous causal loop models presented in the diagrams.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this.
The weakness in this section is a stark disparity in analytical rigor between how the text handles systemic failure versus how it handles systemic success.
That's a great way to put it.
The material uses highly systematic structural mapping to illustrate civilizational collapse.
Like figure 2.
Right, the fragility cascade. It maps out meticulously how environmental stress increases institutional strain, which amplifies distributional conflict, which ultimately triggers a legitimacy crisis.
The visual and mathematical language of collapse is incredibly robust there.
However, when the text presents historical successes, like the European coal and steel community in the aftermath of World War II, or the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it relies almost entirely on standard historical recounting.
It just tells the story of these triumphs, but it doesn't map them using the architecture's own variables.
Right. It tells us that these historical interventions worked, but it misses a major opportunity to mathematically or visually show us how they worked within the established rules of the violence viability framework.
We have this highly formal, interconnected architecture explaining exactly how systems fall apart, variable by variable.
Exactly.
But looking at the post-war European reconstruction or the expansion of welfare states, the analytical machinery just powers down.
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered the implications of that imbalance.
What do you mean?
If the framework is meant to be universally applicable, it must be able to structurally decode systemic recovery just as effectively as it decodes systemic decay.
That's a very fair point.
Without that reverse proof, the framework risks appearing deterministic, heavily weighted toward diagnosing inevitable collapse rather than facilitating adaptation.
The suggestion, then, is to retroactively map the historical case studies directly onto the text's theoretical diagrams and formulas.
Yes. By taking these real-world historical transitions and charting them visually and mathematically, the authors can empirically demonstrate how structural repair actually functions within the architecture they've built.
It would instantly elevate the historical section from a collection of hopeful anecdotes into a set of empirical proofs.
Is the connection between the theoretical formulas and the historical case studies fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster?
It's definitely an area to bolster, because right now the history feels disconnected from the math.
Walking the reader through a concrete example, like the European coal and steel community, by explicitly mapping it onto the core viability framework would bridge that gap.
Applying the viability function directly to the ESCC is a great way to ground the math.
They could dedicate a paragraph to showing exactly how the ESCC altered the I, the institutions, to collectively manage the L, the life ground resources of coal and steel.
Visually representing how pooling the material inputs of warfare under a supranational institution directly neutralized the structural incentives for conflict would show the abstract formula working as a proven historical engine.
Right.
It proves that manipulating the I variable can stabilize the L variable, averting a collapse in the overall V, or viability.
We can apply the same structural overlay to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Okay, how would that look?
The text currently describes the TRC as a triumph of narrative repair, which is true, but it doesn't tie it back to the specific models introduced earlier.
It doesn't.
The authors could use the TRC as a step-by-step overlay on Figure 4, which outlines the adaptive repair cycle of civilizations.
Oh, I see.
They could point out exactly how the TRC functioned as a deliberate institutional intervention at the narrative contestation node.
That's a great catch. Figure 4 shows that when a crisis hits, society splits into either reflexive narratives or adversarial narratives.
Yes.
Adversarial narratives lead down failure pathway 1, resulting in civil conflict and authoritarian consolidation. Reflexive narratives lead to adaptation.
By publicly acknowledging abuses and humanizing both victims and perpetrators, the TRC was effectively an institutional mechanism designed to force the society down the reflexive narrative pathway.
Mapping the South African transition directly onto the nodes of Figure 4 proves that the adaptive repair cycle isn't just a theoretical flowchart.
It demonstrates that societies can purposefully engineer institutions to shift the cultural variable, the C, to maintain viability and bypass failure pathway 1.
Forcing the historical cures through the same rigorous diagnostic machinery as the historical diseases brings a tremendous amount of empirical weight to the text.
It really does. It proves that the violence viability architecture is not just a way to predict systemic decay, but a legitimate schematic for engineering resilience.
The reader walks away possessing a verified, structural blueprint for how complex civilizations can be rebuilt.
These structural changes will ensure the material functions at the highest possible level. It moves the text from diagnosis into active, verifiable intervention.
This has been a deeply rewarding analysis of an incredibly robust, ambitious synthesis of systems theory.
It has. The foundational work bridging ecological constraints, institutional governance, and human neurobiology is exceptionally strong.
To summarize the actionable suggestions to further strengthen the work. First, mathematically encode the information and media layer into the dynamic viability function, ensuring the formal models reflect the prose's insights on the epistemic commons.
Second, add a strategic countermeasure column to the vested interest audit, providing reform coalitions with a concrete playbook for overcoming systemic blockades.
And third, explicitly map the historical case studies of repair onto the causal loop diagrams to prove the model's reverse efficacy and empirically ground the theories of systemic transformation.
We invite the listener to implement these high-level structural changes, continue refining this vital framework, and submit the revised material back in for a future critique.